organization with a broad set of entrepreneurs and be helpful to them. His critics were right. Lots of venture capitalists ended up reading it. When I talked about specific companies I was excited about, getting deals became more competitive. But that was the price that Hornick was willing to pay. My focus was entirely on creating value for entrepreneurs, he says. And he has maintained the blog for the past 8 years. Hornick's second unconventional move was ignited by his frustration with dull speakers at conferences. Back in college, he had teamed up with a professor to run a speaker's bureau so he could invite interesting people to campus. The lineup included the inventor of the game Dungeons and Dragons, the world yo-yo champion, and the animator who created the Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner cartoon characters for Warner Brothers. By comparison, speakers at venture capital and technology conferences weren't measuring up. I discovered that I stopped going in to hear the speakers, and I would spend all my time chatting with people in the lobby about what they're working on. The real value of these events was the conversations and relationships that were created between people. What if a conference was about conversations and relationships, not content? In 2007, Hornick planned his first annual conference. It was called The Lobby, and the goal was to bring entrepreneurs together to share ideas about new media. Hornick was putting about $400,000 on the line, and people tried to talk him out of it. "You could destroy your firm's reputation," they warned, hinting that if the conference failed, Hornick's own career might be ruined. But he pressed forward, and when it was time to send out invitations, Hornick did the unthinkable. He invited venture capitalists at rival firms to attend the conference. Several colleagues thought he was out of his mind. "Why in the world would you let other venture capitalists come to the conference?" they asked. If Hornick met an entrepreneur with a hot new idea at the lobby, he would have a leg up on landing the investment. Why would he want to give away his advantage and help his competitors find opportunities? Once again, Hornick ignored the naysayers. "I want to create an experience to benefit everyone, not just me." One of the rival venture capitalists who attended liked the format so much that he created his own lobby-style conference, but he didn't invite Hornick or any other venture capitalists. His partners wouldn't let him. Nevertheless, Hornick kept inviting venture capitalists to the lobby. David Hornick recognizes the cost of operating like a giver. "Some people think I'm delusional. They believe the way you achieve is by being a taker," he says. If he were more of a taker, he probably wouldn't accept unsolicited pitches, respond personally to emails, share information with competitors on his blog, or invite his rivals to benefit from the lobby conference. He would protect his time, guard his knowledge, and leverage his connections more carefully. And if he were more of a matcher, he would have asked for quid pro quo with the venture capitalist who attended the lobby, but didn't invite Hornick to his own conference. But Hornick pays more attention to what other people need than to what he gets from them. Hornick has been extremely successful as a venture capitalist while living by his values, and he's widely respected for his generosity. "It's win-win," Hornick reflects. "I get to create an environment where other people can get deals and build relationships, and I live in the world I want to live in." His experience reinforces that giving not only is professionally risky, it can also be professionally rewarding. Understanding what makes giving both powerful and dangerous is the focus of Give and Take. The first section unveils the principles of giver success, illuminating how and why givers rise to the top. I'll show you how successful givers have unique approaches to interactions in four key domains: networking, collaborating, evaluating, and influencing. A close look at networking highlights fresh approaches for developing connections with new contacts and strengthening ties with old contacts. Examining collaboration reveals what it takes to work productively with colleagues and earn their respect. Exploring how we evaluate others offers counterintuitive techniques for judging and developing talent to get the best results out of others. And an analysis of influence sheds light on novel strategies for presenting, selling, persuading, and negotiating, all in the spirit of convincing others to support our ideas and interests. Across these four domains, you'll see what successful givers do differently, and what takers and matchers can learn from their approach. Along the way, you'll find out how America's best networker developed his connections, why the genius behind one of the most successful shows in television history toiled for years in anonymity, how a basketball executive responsible for some of the worst draft busts in history turned things around, whether a lawyer who stumbles on his words can beat a lawyer who speaks with confidence, and how you can spot a taker just from looking at a Facebook profile. In the second part of this program, the focus shifts from the benefits of giving to the costs and how they can be managed. I'll examine how givers protect themselves against burnout and avoid becoming pushovers and doormats. You'll discover how a teacher reduced her burnout by giving more rather than less, how a billionaire made money by giving it away, and the ideal number of hours to volunteer if you want to become happier and live longer. You'll see why giving slowed one consultant's path to partner but accelerated another's, why we misjudge who's a giver and who's a taker, and how givers protect themselves at the bargaining table. You'll also gain knowledge about how givers avoid the bottom of the success ladder and rise to the top by nudging other people away from taking and toward giving. You'll learn about a 90-minute activity that unleashes giving in remarkable ways, and you'll figure out why people give things away for free that they could easily sell for a profit on Craigslist, why some radiologists get better but others get worse, why thinking about Superman makes people less likely to volunteer, and why people named Dennis are unusually likely to become dentists. By the time you finish listening to this program, you may be reconsidering some of your fundamental assumptions about success. If you're a self-sacrificing giver, you'll find plenty of insights for ascending from the bottom to the top of the success ladder. If you endorse giver values but act like a matcher at work, you may be pleasantly surprised by the wealth of opportunities to express your values and find meaning in helping others without compromising your own success. Instead of aiming to succeed first and give back later, you might decide that giving first is a promising path to succeeding later. And if you currently lean toward taking, you may be just tempted to shift in the giver direction, seeking to master the skills of this growing breed of people who achieve success by contributing to others. But if you do it only to succeed, it probably won't work. Chapter 2. The Peacock and the Panda. How givers, takers, and matchers build networks. Every man must decide whether he will walk in the light of creative altruism or in the darkness of destructive selfishness. Martin Luther King Jr., civil rights leader and Nobel Peace Prize winner. Several decades ago, a man who started his life in poverty lived the American dream. He came from humble beginnings, growing up in Missouri farm towns without indoor plumbing. To help support his family, the young man worked long hours on farms and paper routes. He put himself through college at the University of Missouri, graduated Phi Beta Kappa, and completed a master's degree and then a doctorate in economics. He pursued a life of public service, enlisting in the Navy and then serving in several important roles in the U.S. government, earning the Navy Commendation Medal and National Defense Service Medal. From there, he built his own company, where he was chairman and CEO for 15 years. By the time he stepped down, his company was worth $110 billion. with more than 20,000 employees in 40 countries around the world. For 5 consecutive years, Fortune named his company America's Most Innovative Company and one of the 25 best places to work in the country. When asked about his success, he acknowledged the importance of respect, the golden rule, absolute integrity. Everyone knows that I personally have a very strict code of personal conduct that I live by. He set up a charitable family foundation, giving over $2.5 million to more than 250 organizations, and donated 1% of his company's annual profits to charity. His giving attracted the attention of former President George W. Bush, who commended him as a good guy and a generous person. Then, he was indicted. His name was Kenneth Lay, and he is best remembered as a primary villain in the Enron scandal. Enron was an energy, commodities, and securities firm headquartered in Houston. In October 2001, Enron lost $1.2 billion in shareholder equity after reporting third-quarter losses of $618 million, the biggest earnings restatement in U.S. history. In December, Enron went bankrupt, leaving 20,000 employees jobless, many watching their life savings practically erased by the company's fall. Investigators found that Enron had deceived investors by reporting false profits and hiding debts of more than $1 billion, manipulated energy and power markets in California and Texas, and won international contracts by giving illegal bribes to foreign governments. Lay was convicted on 6 counts of conspiracy and fraud. We can debate about how much Lay truly knew about Enron's illegal activities, but it's difficult to deny that he was a taker. Although Lay may have looked like a giver to many observers, he was a faker, a taker in disguise. Lay felt entitled to use Enron's resources for personal gain. As Bethany McLean and Peter Elkind describe in The Smartest Guys in the Room, Lay took exorbitant loans from the company and had his staff put his sandwiches on silver platters and fine china. A secretary once tried to reserve an Enron plane for an executive to do business, only to learn that the Lay family was currently using 3 Enron planes for personal travel. From 1997 to 1998, $4.5 million in Enron commissions went to a travel agency owned by Lay's sister. According to accusations, he sold more than $70 million in stock just before Enron went bankrupt, taking the treasure from a sinking ship. This behavior was foreshadowed in the 1970s, when Lay worked at Exxon. A boss wrote a reference recommending Lay highly, but warned that he was maybe too ambitious. Observers now believe that as early as 1987, at Enron Oil, Lay approved and helped to conceal the activities of 2 traders who set up fake companies and stole $3.8 million while allowing Enron to avoid massive trading losses. When the losses were discovered, Enron Oil had to report an $85 million hit, and Lay denied knowledge and responsibility. If anyone could say that I knew, let them stand up. According to McLean and Elkind, one trader started to stand up, but was physically restrained by 2 colleagues. How did a taker end up becoming so successful? He knew somebody. In fact, he knew a whole lot of somebodies. Ken Lay profited greatly from claiming his company's financial resources as his own, but much of his success in growing that company came the old-fashioned way. He built a network of influential contacts and leveraged them for his own benefit. Lay was a master networker from the start. In college, he impressed an economics professor named Pinckney Walker and started his ascent on the shoulders of Walker's connections. Walker helped Lay land an assignment as an economist at the Pentagon, and then a position as a chief assistant in the White House in the Nixon administration. By the mid-1980s, Lay became the head of Enron after engineering the company's move to Houston following a merger. As he consolidated his power, He began to hobnob with political power brokers who could support Enron's interests. He put Pinckney Walker's brother, Charles, on Enron's board and developed a relationship with George H.W. Bush, who was running for president. In 1990, Lay co-chaired an important Summit of Industrialized Nations meeting for Bush in Houston, putting on a dazzling show and charming the crowd, which included British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, and French President François Mitterrand. After Bush lost his re-election bid to Bill Clinton, Lay wasted no time in reaching out to a friend who was a key aide to the president-elect. The friend had gone to kindergarten with Clinton. Soon Lay was playing golf with the new president. Several years later, as George W. Bush gained power, Lay used his connections to lobby for energy deregulation and get his supporters in important government positions in Texas and the White House, influencing policies in Enron's favor. At nearly every stage in his career, Lay was able to dramatically improve his company's prospects, or his own, by making use of well-placed contacts in his network. For centuries, we have recognized the importance of networking. According to Brian Utsi, a management professor at Northwestern University, networks come with three major advantages: private information, diverse skills, and power. By developing a strong network, people gain invaluable access to knowledge, expertise, and influence. Extensive research demonstrates that people with rich networks achieve higher performance ratings, get promoted faster, and earn more money. And because networks are based on interactions and relationships, they serve as a powerful prism for understanding the impact of reciprocity styles on success. How do people relate to others in their networks, and what do they see as the purpose of networking? On the one hand, the very notion of networking often has negative connotations. When we meet a new person who expresses enthusiasm about connecting, we frequently wonder whether he's acting friendly because he's genuinely interested in a relationship that will benefit both of us, or because he wants something from us. At some point in your life, you probably experienced the frustration of dealing with slick schmoozers who are nice to your face when they want a favor, but end up stabbing you in the back or simply ignoring you after they get what they want. This faker style of networking casts the entire enterprise as Machiavellian, a self-serving activity in which people make connections for the sole purpose of advancing their own interests. On the other hand, givers and matchers often see networking as an appealing way to connect with new people and ideas. We meet many people throughout our professional and personal lives, and since we all have different knowledge and resources, it makes sense to turn to these people to exchange help, advice, and introductions. This raises a fundamental question. Can people build up networks that have breadth and depth using different reciprocity styles? Or does one style consistently create a richer network? In this chapter, I want to examine how givers, takers, and matchers develop fundamentally distinct networks, and why their interactions within these networks have different characters and consequences. You'll see how givers and takers build and manage their networks differently, and learn about some clues that they leak along the way, including how we could have recognized the takers at Enron 4 years before the company collapsed. Ultimately, I want to argue that while givers and takers may have equally large networks, givers are able to produce far more lasting value throughout their networks and in ways that might not seem obvious. In 2011, Fortune conducted extensive research to identify the best networker in the United States. The goal was to use online social networks to figure out who had the most connections to America's most powerful people. The staff compiled a list of the Fortune 500 CEOs, as well as Fortune's lists of the 50 smartest people in technology, the 50 most powerful women, and the 40 hottest rising stars in business under age 40. Then, they cross-referenced this list of 640 powerful people against LinkedIn's entire database of more than 90 million members. The winning networker was connected on LinkedIn to more of Fortune's 640 movers and shakers than anyone else on Earth. The winner had more than 3,000 LinkedIn connections, including Netscape co-founder Mark Andreessen, Twitter co-founder Evan Williams, Flickr co-founder Katarina Fake, Facebook co-founder Dustin Moskovitz, Napster co-founder Sean Parker, and Half.com founder Josh Kopelman. Not to mention the former chef of the Grateful Dead. As you'll see later, this networker extraordinaire is a giver. It seems counterintuitive, but the more altruistic your attitude, the more benefits you will gain from the relationship, writes LinkedIn founder Reid Hoffman. If you set out to help others, he explains, you will rapidly reinforce your own reputation and expand your universe of possibilities. Part of this, I'll argue, has to do with the way networks themselves have changed and are still evolving. At the heart of my inquiry, though, lies an exploration of how the motives with which we approach networking shape the strength and reach of those networks, as well as the way that energy flows through them. Spotting the taker in a giver's clothes. If you've ever put your guard up when meeting a new colleague, it's probably because you thought you picked up on the scent of self-serving motives. When we see a taker coming, we protect ourselves by closing the door to our networks, withholding our trust and help. To avoid getting shut out, many takers become good fakers, acting generously so that they can waltz into our networks disguised as givers or matchers. For the better part of 2 decades, this worked for Ken Lay, whose favors and charitable contributions enabled people to see him in a positive light, opening the door to new ties and sources of help. But it can be difficult for takers to keep up the facade in all of their interactions. Ken Lay was charming when mingling with powerful people in Washington, but many of his peers and subordinates saw through him. Looking back, one former Enron employee said, if you wanted to get Lay to attend a meeting, you needed to invite someone important. There's a Dutch phrase that captures his duality beautifully. Kissing up, kicking down. Although takers tend to be dominant and controlling with subordinates, they're surprisingly submissive and deferential toward superiors. When takers deal with powerful people, they become convincing fakers. Takers want to be admired by influential superiors, so they go out of their way to charm and flatter. As a result, powerful people tend to form glowing first impressions of takers. A trio of German psychologists found that when strangers first encountered people, the ones they liked most were those with a sense of entitlement and a tendency to manipulate and exploit others. When kissing up, takers are often good fakers. In 1998, when Wall Street analysts visited Enron, Lay recruited 70 employees to pretend to be busy traders, hoping to wow the analysts with the image of a productive energy trading business. Lay led the analysts through the charade, where the employees were asked to bring personal photos to a different floor of the building so it looked like they worked there, and put on a show. They made imaginary phone calls, creating a ruse that they were busy buying and selling energy and gas. This is another sign that Lay was a taker. He was obsessed with making a good impression upward, but worried less about how he was seen by those below him. As Samuel Johnson purportedly wrote, "The true measure of a man is how he treats someone who can do him absolutely no good." Takers may rise by kissing up, but they often fall by kicking down. When Lay sought to impress the Wall Street analysts, he did so by exploiting his own employees, asking them to compromise their integrity to construct a facade that would deceive the analysts. Research shows that as people gain power, they feel large and in charge, less constrained and freer to express their natural tendencies. As takers gain power, they pay less attention to how they're perceived by those below and next to them. They feel entitled to pursue self-serving goals and claim as much value as they can. Over time, treating peers and subordinates poorly jeopardizes their relationships and reputations. After all, most people are matchers. Their core values emphasize fairness, equality, and reciprocity. When takers violate these principles, matchers in their networks believe in an eye for an eye, so they want to see justice served. To illustrate, imagine that you're participating in a famous study led by Daniel Kahneman, a Nobel Prize-winning psychologist at Princeton. You're playing what's known as the ultimatum game, and you sit down across the table from a stranger who has just been given $10. His task is to present you with a proposal about how the money will be divided between the two of you. It's an ultimatum. You can either accept the proposal as it stands and split the money as proposed, or you can reject it, and both of you will get nothing. You might never see each other again, so he acts like a taker, keeping $8 and offering you only $2. What do you do? In terms of pure profit, it's rational for you to accept the offer. After all, $2 is better than nothing. But if you're like most people, you reject it. You're willing to sacrifice the money to punish the taker for being unfair, walking away with nothing just to keep him from earning $8. Evidence shows that the vast majority of people in this position reject proposals that are imbalanced to the tune of 80% or more for the divider. Why do we punish takers for being unfair? It's not spite. We're not getting revenge on takers for trying to take advantage of us. It's about justice. If you're a matcher, you'll also punish takers for acting unfairly toward other people. In another study, spearheaded by Kahneman, people had a choice between splitting $12 evenly with a taker who had made an unfair proposal in the past, or splitting $10 evenly with a matcher who had made a fair proposal in the past. More than 80% of the people preferred to split $10 evenly with the matcher, accepting $5 rather than $6 to prevent the taker from getting $6. In networks, new research shows that when people get burned by takers, they punish them by sharing reputational information. Gossip represents a widespread, efficient, and low-cost form of punishment, write the social scientists Matthew Feinberg, Joey Chang, and Rob Weiler. When reputational information suggests that someone has taker tendencies, we can withhold trust and avoid being exploited. Over time, as their reputation spread, takers end up cutting existing ties and burning bridges with potential new ties. When Lay's taking was revealed, many of his former supporters, including the Bush family, distanced themselves from him. As Wayne Baker, a University of Michigan sociologist and networking expert, explains, if we create networks with the sole intention of getting something, we won't succeed. We can't pursue the benefits of networks. The benefits ensue from investments in meaningful activities and relationships. Before we make the leap of investing in relationships, though, we need to be able to recognize takers in our everyday interactions. For many of us, a challenge of networking lies in trying to guess the motives or intentions of a new contact, especially since we've seen that takers can be quite adept at posing as givers when there's a potential return. Is the next person you meet interested in a genuine connection or merely seeking personal gains? And is there a good way to tell the difference? Luckily, research shows that takers leak clues. Well, more precisely, takers lack clues. In the animal kingdom, lecking refers to a ritual in which males show off their desirability as mates. When it's time to breed, they gather in a common place and take their established positions. They put on extravagant displays to impress and court female audiences. Some do mating dances. Some sing alluring songs. Some even do acrobatics. The most striking display of lecking occurs among male peacocks. Each mating season, the males assume their positions and begin parading their plumage. They strut, they spread their feathers, they spin around to flaunt their tails. In the CEO kingdom, Takers do a dance that looks remarkably similar. In a landmark study, strategy professors Arjit Chatterjee and Donald Hambrick studied more than 100 CEOs in computer hardware and software companies. They analyzed each company's annual reports over more than a decade, looking for signs of lekking. What they found would forever change the face of leadership. It turns out that we could have anticipated the collapse of Enron as early as 1997, without ever meeting Ken Lay or looking at a single number. The warning signs of Enron's demise are visible in a single image, captured 4 years before the company unraveled. Consider two pictures of CEOs that appeared in their company's annual reports. Both men started their lives in poverty, worked in the Nixon administration, founded their own companies, became rich CEOs, and donated substantial sums of money to charity. One picture is of John Huntsman Sr., a giver whom we'll meet in Chapter 6, from his company's 2006 annual report. The other image depicts Ken Lay. Thousands of experts have analyzed Enron's financial statements, but they've missed an important fact. A picture really is worth a thousand words. Had we looked more carefully at the Enron reports, we might have recognized the telltale signs of takers lekking at the helm. But these signs aren't where I expected to find them. They're not in the faces or attire of the CEOs. In their study of CEOs in the computer industry, Chatterjee and Hambrick had a hunch that takers would see themselves as the suns in their company's solar systems. They found several clues of takers lekking at the top. One signal appeared in CEO interviews. Since takers tend to be self-absorbed, they're more likely to use first-person singular pronouns like I, me, mine, my, and myself, versus first-person plural pronouns like we, us, our, ours, and ourselves. In the computer industry, when talking about the company, on average, 21% of CEOs' first-person pronouns were in the singular. For the extreme takers, 39% of their first-person pronouns were in the singular. Of every 10 words that the taker CEOs uttered, referencing themselves, 4 were about themselves alone and no one else. Another signal was compensation. The taker CEOs earned far more money than other senior executives in their companies. The takers saw themselves as superior, so they felt entitled to substantial pay discrepancies in their own favor. In the computer industry, a typical taker CEO took home more than triple the annual salary and bonus of anyone else in the company. By contrast, the average across the industry was for CEOs to earn just over 1.5 times the next highest paid. The taker CEOs also commanded stock options and other non-cash compensation of 7 times higher than the next highest paid, compared with the industry average of 2.5 times higher. But the most interesting clue was in the annual reports that the companies produced for shareholders each year. Recall the pictures of Ken Lay and John Huntsman Sr. that I referenced before, but now they're in context. One photo appeared in Huntsman's 2006 annual report. His image is tiny, taking up less than 10% of the page. The other photo appeared in Enron's 1997 annual report. The image of Lay takes up an entire page. When Chatterjee and Hambrick looked at the annual reports from the computer companies, they noticed dramatic differences in the prominence of the CEO's image. In some annual reports, the CEO wasn't pictured at all. In other reports, there was a full-page photo of the CEO alone. Guess which one is the taker? For the taker CEOs, it was all about me. A big photo is self-glorifying, sending a clear message. I am the central figure in this company. But is this really a signal of being a taker? To find out, Chatterjee and Hambrick invited security analysts who specialized in the information technology sector to rate the CEOs. The analysts rated whether each CEO had an inflated sense of self that is reflected in feelings of superiority, entitlement, and a constant need for attention and admiration. Enjoying being the center of attention, insisting upon being shown a great deal of respect, exhibitionism, and arrogance. The analyst ratings correlated almost perfectly with the size of the CEO's photos. At Enron, in the prescient 1997 report, the spotlight was on Ken Lay. Of the first 9 pages, 2 were dominated by giant full-page images of Lay and then COO Jeff Skilling. The pattern continued in 1998 and 1999 with full-page photos of Lay and Skilling. By 2000, Lay and Skilling had moved up to pages 4 and 5, albeit with smaller images. There were 4 different photos of each of them, like a film strip, only they were better fit for a cartoon. 3 of the photos of Lay were virtually identical, revealing the subtle smug smile of an executive who knew he was special. A fairy tale ending was not in the cards for Lay, who died of a heart attack before sentencing. So far, we've looked at 2 different ways to recognize takers. First, when we have access to reputational information, we can see how people have treated others in their networks. Second, when we have a chance to observe the actions and imprints of takers, we can look for signs of lacking. Self-glorifying images, self-absorbed conversations, and sizable pay gaps can send accurate, reliable signals that someone is a taker. Thanks to some dramatic changes in the world since 2001, these signals are easier to spot today than ever before. Networks have become more transparent, providing us with new windows through which we can view other people's reputations and lacking. The Transparent Network. In 2002, just months after Enron fell apart, a computer scientist by the name of Jonathan Abrams founded Friendster, creating the world's first online social network. Friendster made it possible for people to post their profiles online and broadcast their connections to the world. In the following 2 years, entrepreneurs launched LinkedIn, MySpace, and Facebook. Strangers now had access to one another's relationships and reputations. By 2012, the world population reached 7 billion. At the same time, Facebook's active users approached 1 billion, meaning that more than 10% of the people in the world are connected on Facebook. Social networks have always existed, writes psychologist Benjamin Crozier, Gregory Webster, and Haley Dillon. It's only recently that the internet has provided a venue for their electronic explosion. From mundane communication to meeting the love of one's life to inciting political revolutions, network ties are the conduits by which information and resources are spread. These online connections have simulated a defining feature of the old world. Before technological revolutions helped us communicate by phone and email, and travel by car and plane, people had relatively manageable numbers of social ties in tightly connected, transparent circles. Within these insulated networks, people could easily gather reputational information and observe lacking. As communication and transportation became easier, and the sheer size of the population grew, interactions became more dispersed and anonymous. Reputations and lacking became less visible. This is why Ken Lay was able to keep much of his taking hidden. As he moved from one position and organization to another, his contacts didn't always have easy access to one another, and the new people who entered his network didn't gain a great deal of information about his reputation. Inside Enron, His impromptu actions couldn't be documented on YouTube, broadcast on Twitter, easily indexed in a Google search, or posted anonymously on internal blogs or the company intranet. Now it's much harder for takers to get away with being fakers, fooling people into thinking they're givers. On the internet, we can now track down reputational information about our contacts by accessing public databases and discovering shared connections. And we no longer need a company's annual report to catch a taker, because lekking, in its many sizes and forms, abounds in social network profiles. Tiny cues, like words and photos, can reveal profound clues about us. And research suggests that ordinary people can identify takers just by looking at their Facebook profiles. In one study, psychologists asked people to fill out a survey measuring whether they were takers. Then, the psychologists sent strangers to visit their Facebook pages. The strangers were able to detect the takers with astonishing accuracy. The takers posted information that was rated as more self-promoting, self-absorbed, and self-important. They featured quotes that were evaluated as boastful and arrogant. The takers also had significantly more Facebook friends, racking up superficial connections so they could advertise their accomplishments and stay in touch to get favors, and posted vainer, more flattering pictures of themselves. Howard Lee, the former head of South China at Groupon, is one of a growing number of people who use social media to catch takers. When Lee hired salespeople, many of the strong candidates were aggressive, making it difficult to distinguish the takers from the candidates who were simply gregarious and driven. Lee was enamored with one candidate who had an outstanding resume, aced his interview, and had glowing references. But the candidate could have been faking. Talking to someone for an hour only gives you a glimpse, the tip of the iceberg, Lee thought. And the references were self-selected. A taker could easily find some superiors to sing his praises. So Lee searched through his LinkedIn and Facebook networks and identified a mutual connection who shared some disconcerting information about the candidate. He seemed to be a taker, and it carried a lot of weight. If he's been ruthless in one company, do I want to work with him? Lee feels that online social networks have revolutionized Groupon's hiring process. Nowadays, I don't need to call into a company to find out about someone's reputation. Everyone is incredibly connected. Once they make it past the technical rounds, I check their LinkedIn or Facebook. Sometimes we have mutual friends, or went to the same school, or the people on my team will have a link to them, Lee explains. You can understand someone's reputation at a peer level pretty quickly. When your relationships and reputations are visible to the world, it's harder to achieve sustainable success as a taker. In Silicon Valley, a quiet man who looks like a panda bear is taking transparent networks to the next level. His name is Adam Forrest Rifkin, and he has been called the giant panda of programming. He describes himself as a shy, introverted computer nerd who has two favorite languages, JavaScript, the computer programming language, and Klingon, the language spoken by the aliens on Star Trek. Rifkin is an anagrammaniac. He has spent countless hours rearranging the letters in his name to find the one that captures him best, generating candidates such as Offer Radiant Smirk and Feminist Radar Fork. Rifkin has two master's degrees in computer science, owns a patent, and has developed supercomputer applications for NASA and internet systems for Microsoft. As the new millennium approached, Rifkin co-founded KnowNow, a software startup with Rohit Khare, helping companies manage information more efficiently and profitably. KnowNow achieved a decade of success after bringing in more than $50 million in venture funding. By 2009, while still in his 30s, Rifkin announced his retirement. I came across Rifkin while scrolling through the LinkedIn connections of David Hornick, the venture capitalist whom you met in the previous chapter. When I clicked on Rifkin's profile, I saw that he was coming out of retirement to launch a startup called Panda Whale, with the goal of creating a public permanent record of the information that people exchange. Since Rifkin is clearly a staunch advocate of transparency in networks, I was curious to see what his own network looks like. So I did what's only natural in a connected world. I went to Google and typed Adam Rifkin. As I scrolled through the search results, the 16th link caught my eye. It said that Adam Rifkin was Fortune's best networker. What goes around comes around. In 2011, Adam Rifkin had more LinkedIn connections to the 640 powerful people on Fortune's lists than any human being on the planet. He beat out luminaries like Michael Dell, the billionaire founder of the Dell Computer Company, and Jeff Weiner, the CEO of LinkedIn. I was stunned that a shy, Star Trek-loving, anagram-obsessing software geek managed to build a network that includes the founders of Facebook, Netscape, Napster, Twitter, Flickr, and Half.com. Adam Rifkin built his network by operating as a bona fide giver. My network developed little by little. In fact, a little every day through small gestures and acts of kindness over the course of many years, Rifkin explains, with a desire to make better the lives of the people I'm connected to. Since 1994, Rifkin has served as a leader and watchdog in a wide range of online communities, working diligently to strengthen relationships and help people resolve online conflicts. As the co-founder of Renku, a startup with Joyce Park, Rifkin created applications that were used more than 500 million times by more than 36 million people on Facebook and MySpace. Despite their popularity, Rifkin wasn't satisfied. If you're going to get tens of millions of people using your software, you really should do something meaningful, something that changes the world, he says. Frankly, I would like to see more people helping other people. He decided to shut down Renku and become a full-time giver, offering extensive guidance to startups and working to connect engineers and entrepreneurs with business people in larger companies. To this end, in 2005, Rifkin and Joyce Park founded 106 Miles, a professional network with the social mission of educating entrepreneurial engineers through dialogue. This network has brought together more than 5,000 entrepreneurs who meet twice every month to help one another learn and succeed. I get roped into giving free advice to other entrepreneurs, which is usually worth less than they pay for it, he muses. But helping others is my favorite thing to do. This approach has led to great things, not just for Rifkin, but also for those he's shepherded along the way. In 2001, Rifkin was a big fan of Blogger, an early blog publishing service. Blogger had run out of funding, so Rifkin offered a contract to Blogger's founder to do some work for his own first startup, KnowNow. We decided to hire him because we wanted to see Blogger survive, Rifkin says. We gave him a contract to build something for our company so we could use it as a demo and he could keep Blogger going. The money from the contract helped the founder keep Blogger afloat, and he went on to co-found a company called Twitter. There were several other people who also contracted with Evan Williams so he could keep his company going, Rifkin reflects. You never know where somebody's going to end up. It's not just about building your reputation. It really is about being there for other people. In the search for Fortune's best networker, when Rifkin popped up as the winner, the reporter on the story, Jessica Shambora, laughed out loud. Not surprisingly, I had already met him. Someone had referred me to him for a story I was researching on virtual goods and social networks. Shambora, who now works at Facebook, says that Rifkin is the consummate networker, and he didn't get that way by being some sort of climber or calculated. People go to Adam because they know his heart is in the right place. When he first moved up to Silicon Valley, Rifkin felt that giving was a natural way to come out of his shell. As a very shy, sheltered computer guy, the concept of the network was my North Star, he says. When you have nothing, what's the first thing you try to do? You try to make a connection and have a relationship that gives you an opportunity to do something for someone else. On Rifkin's LinkedIn page, his motto is, "I want to improve the world, and I want to smell good while doing it." As of September 2012, on LinkedIn, 49 people have written recommendations for Rifkin, and no attribute is mentioned more frequently than his giving. A matcher would write recommendations back for the same 49 people, and perhaps sprinkle in a few unsolicited recommendations for key contacts, in the hopes that they'll reciprocate. But Rifkin gives more than 5 times as much as he gets. On LinkedIn, he has written detailed recommendations for 265 different people. "Adam is off the charts in how much he helps," says the entrepreneur Raymond Roth. "He gives a lot more than he receives. It's part of his mantra to be helpful." Rifkin's networking style, which exemplifies how givers tend to approach networks, stands in stark contrast to the way that takers and matchers tend to build and extract value from their connections. The fact that Rifkin gives a lot more than he receives is a key point. Takers and matchers also give in the context of networks, but they tend to give strategically, with an expected personal return that exceeds or equals their contributions. When takers and matchers network, they tend to focus on who can help them in the near future, and this dictates what, where, and how they give. Their actions tend to exploit a common practice in nearly all societies around the world, in which people typically subscribe to a norm of reciprocity. You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. If you help me, I'm indebted to you, and I feel obligated to repay. According to the psychologist Robert Cialdini, people can capitalize on this norm of reciprocity by giving what they want to receive. Instead of just reactively doing favors for the people who have already helped them, takers and matchers often proactively offer favors to people whose help they want in the future. As networking guru Keith Ferrazzi summarizes in Never Eat Alone, it's better to give before you receive. Ken Lay lived by this principle. He had a knack for doing unrequested favors so that important people would feel compelled to respond in kind. When he was kissing up, he went out of his way to rack up credits with powerful people who he could call in later. In 1994, George W. Bush was running for governor of Texas. Bush was an underdog, but just in case, Lay made a donation of $12,500, as did his wife. Once Bush was elected governor, Lay supported one of Bush's literacy initiatives and ended up writing him 2 dozen lobbying letters. According to one citizen watchdog leader, Lay commanded quid pro quo, helping Bush so that Bush would support utility deregulation. In one letter, Lay subtly hinted at his willingness to continue reciprocating if Bush helped him to advance his goals. "Let me know what Enron can do to be helpful in not only passing electricity restructuring legislation, but also in pursuing the rest of your legislative agenda." Reciprocity is a powerful norm, but it comes with 2 downsides, both of which contribute to the cautiousness with which many of us approach networking. The first downside is that people on the receiving end often feel like they're being manipulated. Dan Weinstein, a former Olympic speed skater and current marketing consultant at Resource Systems Group, notes that some of the bigger management consulting firms own box seats at major sporting events. When these firms offer Red Sox tickets to their clients, the clients know that they're doing so, at least in part, with the hopes of getting something in return. When favors come with strings attached or implied, the interaction can leave a bad taste, feeling more like a transaction than part of a meaningful relationship. Do you really care about helping me, or are you just trying to create quid pro quo so that you can ask for a favor? Apparently, Ken Lay made such an impression on George W. Bush. When Bush was running for governor, he asked Lay to chair one of his finance campaigns. At the time, Lay didn't think Bush had a chance, so he declined, stating that he was already serving on a business council for the Democratic incumbent, Ann Richards. As a consolation prize, he made his $12,500 donation. Then, toward the end of the campaign, when it looked like Bush had a good chance of winning, Lay quickly made another donation of $12,500. Even though Lay ended up donating more money to Bush than to Richards, his decision to give only when it was strategic left an indelible dent in the relationship. This decision relegated him forever to the periphery of George W. Bush's inner circle, wrote one journalist, citing a dozen insiders who confided that Lay created a distance between them that was never really bridged. Bush never invited Lay to stay in the White House, as his father had. When the Enron scandal broke, Lay reached out to a number of political officials for help, but Bush wasn't one of them. The relationship wasn't strong enough. There's a second downside of reciprocity, and it's one to which matchers are especially vulnerable. Matchers tend to build smaller networks than either givers, who seek actively to help a wider range of people, or takers, who often find themselves expanding their networks to compensate for bridges burned in previous transactions. Many matchers operate based on the attitude of, "I'll do something for you if you'll do something for me," writes LinkedIn founder Reid Hoffman. So they limit themselves to deals in which their immediate benefit is at least as great as the benefits for others. If you insist on a quid pro quo every time you help others, you will have a much narrower network. When matchers give with the expectation of receiving, they direct their giving toward people who they think can help them. After all, if you don't benefit from having your favors reciprocated, what's the value of being a matcher? As these disadvantages of strict reciprocity accrue over time, they can limit both the quantity and quality of the networks that takers and matchers develop. Both disadvantages ultimately arise out of a short-sightedness about networks, in that takers and matchers make hard and fast assumptions about just who will be able to provide the most benefit in exchange. At its core, the giver approach extends a broader reach, and in doing so, enlarges the range of potential payoffs, even though these payoffs are not the motivating engine. When you meet people, says former Apple evangelist and Silicon Valley legend Guy Kawasaki, regardless of who they are, you should just be asking yourself, how can I help the other person? This may strike some as a way to overinvest in others. But as Adam Rifkin once learned to great effect, we can't always predict who can help us. Waking the Sleeping Giants. In 1993, a college student named Graham Spencer teamed up with five friends to build an internet startup. Spencer was a shy, introverted computer engineer with a receding hairline, huge glasses, and an obsession with comic books. Looking back, he says Superman taught him justice and virtue, the X-Men kindled concern for oppressed groups, and Spider-Man gave him hope. Even superheroes could have a rough time in school. Spencer and his friends co-founded Excite, an early web portal and search engine that quickly became one of the most popular sites on the internet. In 1998, Excite was purchased for $6.7 billion And Spencer was flying high as its largest shareholder and chief technology officer. In 1999, shortly after selling Excite, Spencer received an email out of the blue from Adam Rifkin, who was asking for advice on a startup. They had never met, but Spencer volunteered to sit down with Rifkin anyway. After they met, Spencer connected Rifkin with a venture capitalist who ended up funding his startup. How did Rifkin get access to Spencer? And why did Spencer go out of his way to help Rifkin?